going through a lot of these issues that I just recently have gone through with my family physician, and I had a run-in with the PA at my doctor's office who did not believe, and I think she had no knowledge of gastroparesis. I was made to feel like a drug addict, and she as much told me that I was acting and sounding like a drug addict, that I was seeking drugs because I asked for something for pain. And I feel like my gastroenterologist doesn't really have much knowledge of gastroparesis either. And I do have major depression. I have a caseworker who sees me on a weekly basis, and she understands what I'm going through. But I feel like I'm at the end of my rope out here with not getting much support. And I just feel like since I found this group that this is where I do keep my sanity, by getting on here every single day and reading the comments that people have made. And I just say that this group is a godsend for me, because my depression has definitely worsened since my gastroparesis has flared up in the last month. And I just don't, like I say, every day is just getting to be more and more of a struggle for me.
Yeah. I feel for you, and I'm sure everybody on this call or internet, whatever device you're using, I'm sure all of us, well, we certainly understand, and I'm sure all of us within the course of our illness have experienced that, not being believed and not really knowing anybody who has it. There are so many layers that are involved in this, and it's very lonely, very isolating, and it can be very depressing. And I know that when you see a gastroenterologist, I just want to point this out, that a lot of patients will see a general gastroenterologist, and that can work out okay. But when you have a motility problem, especially an acute problem, it's important that you are in communication or have seen a digestive motility expert. So a doctor will go to school and they'll learn about the digestive tract, and then they do the fellowship in gastroenterology. But if they want to educate themselves further in motility, then they will do extra fellowship with a motility expert. And then on top of that, you have motility experts who are specialized in certain areas of the digestive tract. So medicine has become so ultra-specialized. So if you have an esophageal problem, you go to an esophageal motility expert. If you go to somebody with a gastroparesis, you go to somebody with expertise in that. There are some doctors with expertise in all of it. But just to give a hint, that I get so many calls and emails from patients going, look, I don't know where to go. The GI, I'm going from one GI to another, and they have no clue. And it could possibly be that the expertise is not in that, just for your info.
Yeah.
But,
think the closest one to me is like 3 hours away. One that specializes in gastroparesis is 3 hours away, and I could probably go maybe one time, but I don't know if a one-time visit would help me or not.
Sometimes what happens is if you've gone to a motility expert, but that expert is too far away, once you see that doctor and they do a generalized or whatever testing they need, and they do the patient history and all of that, what you just say to the doctor is that, I'm living too far away to make this my regular visit. Perhaps if we can touch bases periodically. But what that doctor can do, if the doctor is willing, is communicate with your doctor. Uh-huh. And they can be in contact with each other. So if you have your general gastroenterologist and they stay in contact with each other, that can be very helpful. And I know some patients who do that. Even doctors who have moved away out of state, they can still give, you know, they're welcome to embrace. I know somebody who goes to Pennsylvania like once a year, even though it's quite a ways for them and they're physically really, it's a challenge for them. However, that doctor can communicate with their doctor to make sure that...
Yeah, that's where I live in Pennsylvania. Yeah, okay, I'll keep that in mind.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. It's just, it just is a matter of asking that doctor if they would be okay with that, and then asking the doctor that's close to your home if they're willing to do that as well.
Mary
okay,
Angela?
Okay, thank you.
Donna?
I'm sorry? Yes?
Mary Angela, this is Donna in Washington.
Hi, Donna.
Hi, Donna. I wanted to feedback on her comment. My gastroparesis specialist is 45 minutes away, but my primary care doctor does my blood tests and everything for me and sends the results over my... Because I fired her. He told me it was in my head.
Yeah. I think it's great that they do send the reports over. And that's really helpful. That's really helpful. How many of you on this? I'm sorry, go ahead.
He requests them from her, so I don't have to travel as far.
Yes, that's excellent. And we've done programs on this. We're going to be doing it again. And actually, the Let's Talk series that we have, that's where we have an open discussion on different topics, specific topics. We were supposed to have one that was going to be, that was scheduled for this month, but I personally had to postpone it until next month. But the topic is that, oh, you look so good, or, the topic
it's
is,
all in your head.
It's all in your head. Thank you, Enam. So the topic is, it's all in your head. And those are comments that you have been told by not only the medical community, but perhaps people in your family, friends that you know, social, you know, any situation, even, in the case of just people who don't know you, strangers who say the wildest things, but how many have been told that you look, it's all in your head? And it still goes on today, and it's very frustrating. I know when we started this organization, it was... the American Society of Adults with Pseudoobstruction, and in 2000 the name was changed. And we were, our organization was at a Digestive Disease Week conference, and we were exhibiting, and this is so engraved in my head because I was just stunned. When you have pseudoobstruction, then the term pseudo can also refer to something in your head. A lot of people think it's in your head, but the pseudo means that your intestines are reacting as if, are acting as if there's a true obstruction, even though 9 times out of 10, there won't be an obstruction. That doesn't mean that you don't get one. It means that the intestines are reacting as if you have one. So it mimics it. But as we were at the booth, this one doctor came by our table, and we had some M&Ms in the, as people pass by, a little enticing of doctors and nurses and everybody coming to our table. And this one doctor came over to our table, started eating the M&Ms, and then he looked up at the sign and he went, "You mean there's actually an organization for something like this? This is a head thing." And I was so startled, I didn't even know how to respond, but in my head, I was screaming, "This is the very doctor that needs to learn about this because I feel for his other patients." Within a few minutes later, this other doctor came up to the table. He came rushing up and he said, "Oh my God, let me take all your literature because I have a patient with this and it would mean so much for her to have that kind of support and help." He says, "This is the first time I've heard of an organization for this." And then my faith was so much restored, but that was in the 90s. It frustrates me that it still goes on today with not only the medical community, but with the lack of understanding and the attributing to it all in your head, or you look so good, or, you know, that you don't have that, or it must be like this. Yeah, I get indigestion too, or sometimes I get full. And they don't understand that just a little bite of food can cause all of these problems.
Well, I'm Mary Angela, when you, this is Anon, wanted to make a comment. When you brought the story up about a rocking chair, it reminded me of what happened to me in Pittsburgh. We had just moved to a new city, wanted to go volunteer, had wonderful success before in Chicago, been going to all these different schools. And when I got to Pittsburgh, the head of the vision department goes, "Well, you're blind, you got cerebral palsy and all these health conditions. Just sit home in a rocking chair and don't move, don't do anything." And I'm like, I'm not going to just sit home and just, that's what they wanted me to do, was just sit home in a rocking chair, not to move, not to go anywhere, not to do anything. And I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah, no, it's great that, you know, in some people's lives, they have that ability. Unfortunately, in other people's lives, they're bedridden by it, or their whole quality. I mean, everybody's life is totally changed. And the quality of life can be as either good as you make it or as good as the circumstances will allow. And when you are not feeling good, the last thing you feel like doing is leaving your house, even to see a doctor or just to leave your bed. So we talk to many patients who truly are so consumed by the illness that they just can't get out of bed. And the depression and the anxiety and the fear is rampant in them. Laura, now you have had experience. Laura, are you still there? Laura?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Laura, you've had experience with having the diagnosis of gastroparesis with its top physician, and then that physician moving. And tell us a little bit about that ability to be able to communicate with a doctor, even though you live hundreds of miles away.
Okay, well, when I first I went through a couple of years with one doctor locally, trying to figure out what was wrong with me. And he happened to be reading a medical paper for doctors only about a doctor who was working with this thing called gastroparesis, stomach motility.
What year was this, Laura? Laura, what year was this?
When I, 2000, well, I got it in 2001, but 2003.
Okay.
He saw the, in January, I think, he saw the article. And it said it was all about how most of the patients so far at that point had been 33 to 35 year old type 1 diabetics, have had it for 25 years, you know, it was me. I was like a perfect fit. I had my doctor call my gastroenterologist, see if it was cool with him. Everybody called. I went. I ended up in to see him in Kansas City, and I live in Massachusetts. You know, Boston has the best medical care sometimes. And it so happened that this gentleman in Kansas introduced me to the AGMD here, because he's on the board, but I didn't know that at the time. I had never heard of them. I went back and saw him for 3 months in a row, I think, three or four. And I was on an FDA clinical trial with the PACER, the neurological stimulator. And after that, I was reporting via email and talking to them of any changes or checkups. Well, then he actually, don't know what happened, but him and his whole department are now running the Texas El Paso University Hospital something out that way. And I have still been able to email both of them, him and his top-notch assistant, and get answers and have them tell me what to tell my doctor and how to contact them if my doctor disagrees with their protocols. I find myself incredibly fortunate. I don't think I would have had that kind of relationship if I didn't continue to see him and spent a lot of money getting out there. But they've become, you know, they're a part of my life. Everybody who knows me knows their names. And my doctor is fine with anything they have to say because she's, although she's no expert, she's very up on this stuff. But she knows they know better because that's all they do.
Yeah,
and it's really nice
wonderful.
To be able to. Yeah, and I have my actual email is a good thing. A lot of doctors now, groups, are having, they have a email way to communicate with your doctor and get your records. A lot of them are doing that. I always, if a doctor is even a little bit far away, like an hour, I set it up so that I can talk to them via email if I need to. Because I, you know, I have somebody in Boston, but it's an hour and a half away. He's like, if you have to, if you're acute and you have to go to the hospital, don't come all the way out here. We're going to do the same thing they're going to do 5 minutes from your house. You know, and it's, he's like, but for treatment and knowledge and things, I go to him. So it, does, it can work out. You just keep, you gotta kind of find the right doctors that are into it and hope they think you're interesting. I feel like a guinea pig sometimes.
Yeah, you have to ask the right questions. The worst that can happen is they'll say no. But if you don't ask the right questions, then you'll never ever know, and then you continue on the path that you're on. I have to just add that on our main website at agmd-gimotility.org, we have a listing of physicians in all different states and countries. It's constantly being updated and changed. So if you are in need of physicians with expertise in motility, you can always go on our website. Doesn't mean that we have every single one of them. And I was so pleased that last month a doctor had contacted us from New York, and she said that you could add their clinic on there, their motility clinic, and they said, she said to add her name on the in the database, and we did. And I was just so thrilled to find out that this particular doctor had such great expertise in so many areas of mobility, and it's a great resource for patients that we didn't have before. So,
Mary Angela, I had another
question. Yes, Ina.
When the motility DVDs are up there, a friend was asking me which section would they be under?
I don't know. I don't have an answer yet. It will be in our store, but I don't have the whole answer to that until we get them. Get them all up there, then we'll know. Does anybody else want to focus in on that fear factor, quote-unquote fear factor, or on even the emotional part, or trying to grasp on to living with this, or feeling? Go ahead.
Mariella, this is Donna again.
Hi, Donna.
And I'm going to make kind of a little advertisement for Washington State, because we're having a big meet and greet in June for statewide. So if anyone knows anyone in Washington State, they can contact me.
Oh, that's great. They're having a motility meet and greet, or it's just an introduction to the whole hospital?
It's gastroparesis and parasudo.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so encouraged by hearing that more and more places are becoming aware of it, and more centers are focusing on these particular ones. So as I say to everybody, hold on to that hope. Just hold on to it, because there's a lot of good stuff out there. I'm sorry?
This is going to be in central Washington.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. We live all the way from north, south, east, west of Washington. We're going to meet in the middle.
That's great. Donna, when you have the opportunity, is there a link, or is there a press release of that, what's going to be happening, that you could email to me?
We just have it on Facebook right now.
Okay.
And a notice up at my GI's office, because he serves over 300 motility patients.
Okay. Wow, that's great. even if, so I'll just, perhaps I can send you an email later and then we can communicate a little more about that so I can help to make others aware of it.
That would be
great.
Fabulous.
Okay, so anything that we can do as an organization to help spread the word out about great things that are happening in the field of motility and great events, we certainly will do. Be more than willing to do that.
I also have a fear.
Yes.
And that is my feeding tube.
Mm-hmm.
I've had 4 days, and they were quote unquote foggy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the second GJ, the doctor said it was my anatomy because I had too much mass with nothing supporting it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was 247, I'm now 121.
Mm-hmm.
And then since 2012, that is. I just ended up in the ER on Friday and ended up getting a new DJ where the doctor blamed me for my tube boiling up, but could not tell me why it was my fault. Is anyone?
That just happened actually to somebody else in Massachusetts that I was talking to. And the doctor there, couldn't understand what was going on and didn't want to address it. And then it was the patient who actually kind of insisted, so they did it and then just changed it and set him free. But the reasons were not apparent, and the belief of what was happening was not apparent either. So, unfortunately, it's something that does happen. I would suggest also that ThriveRx is a company. There are 2 things. One is the Oley Foundation. I don't know if you're familiar with the Oley Foundation, but they are sensational with helping patients and drawing an awareness to tubal feedings, enteral, parenteral nutrition. So that's one resource that I highly recommend. They do incredible work, and they can provide a lot of the answers for you. Another one is ThriveRx, which is a company who deals with all of that, provides the parental and enteral nutrition. But they have been so great in helping patients, even if they're not clients of theirs. So if you're interested in that information, you can certainly forward that your way. The 2 great resources of helping to answer some of the questions that, you go through that you may have with all the complications and concerns that deal with that. There are all these fears that do happen on different levels and with different events, and it's compounded by the frustration of the lack of knowledge in there and the lack of treatment, and there's a balance between all of that. How many of you are fearful of even leaving your home?
Me.
Yeah, who's
Donna.
Me?
Me too.
Donna.
Laura.
Yeah.
I won't leave without my husband.
Mm-hmm. Yep. How many of you are fearful when you're home?
Oh, me? Laura?
Yeah, well, I certainly am, because you never know when all of a sudden it's going to get so severe that now you have to go to the hospital. And sometimes with these motility problems, when you go to the emergency, like the last time I was there, the doctor just said, first of all, you have a long name. And then he said, and what do you have? And so when I told him, he said, well, tell me what I should do. Thank God he listened to me, but he had no clue what to do. And then the nurse came over and wanted to know more about it, which was great. But the doctor just obeyed what I had to do. But there's always that fear of, oh, my God, what's going to happen? And then when you're in the hospital itself, sometimes it's that situation that repeats itself, perhaps early on in your journey when, even though you have that definitive diagnosis, there's that new people coming in that don't believe. So it you live with that fear all the time. How many of you have had experiences in the emergency room where all of a sudden they're looking at you like, what the heck is going on? Have any of you?
That
I know
would
Laura
be me, Laura.
Yes. Yeah. Laura, tell us, because you were a frequent flyer at the emergency room.
Never had it put that way, but yes. In my experience since 2001, and with my diabetes, it has caused me to be in the hospital at least 500 times. We're not exactly sure, but we got that high and still had more to count. And out of those 500 times, probably 400 of them would not listen to me. Took a chest x-ray. A couple of them did a CAT scan. My stomach, you know. And they wouldn't listen. And, I mean, I'm probably radioactive by now because there's so many x-rays. I mean, I do know that I don't have pneumonia or anything in my lungs because I used to get to see them on a monthly basis. And it's just because same hospital, but they just, it's either they don't understand and they do it the way they think they should, or it's protocol. You come in throwing up like that, there's got to be a blockage or something causing it, if it's not the flu, you know, which, and I would, because of the diabetes, dehydrate and get really, really sick, but they still make me go down and have an x-ray. Biggest waste of money ever for this disease.
Yeah.
It doesn't even show your stomach.
Yeah. But then again, there's always the risk that it could be something else. So therein lies the problem.
Mm. And what I believe they have by law. They have to try.
Yeah, they have to protect themselves and make sure they're not overlooking something. Like if you have pseudo-obstruction, even though you may have that, that doesn't ensure that you don't have it and you have an obstruction all of a sudden. So or it could be an adhesion that could be causing a problem that is similar to pseudo-obstruction. So you just don't know. But I think there are some helpful tools that you can at least put in place. One is if you have a good GI doctor and you have a good primary care, they can write up a regular protocol that in case of this is what you have, then this is what you would do, this is what you would take, et cetera. These are the steps that you follow. Oh, we're getting an echo from somebody. I'm going to mute somebody here. See. Yeah. The second thing is, why are we getting that echo? The second thing that I suggest is that you literally bring literature with you wherever you go, and that way there, in case they don't know about it or anything like that, then you have official documentation that is explaining what it is and if there are treatments available. I don't know if everybody on call has gastroparesis or if they have gastroparesis plus other things or if they don't have, you know, they have a totally different motility problem. So I'm just going to ask and just say by your voice, and you don't have to give your first name. How many of you, does everybody here have gastroparesis, a yes or no?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Okay. So does the person who said no have pseudo-obstruction?
Yes.
Okay. Does anybody have esophageal problems?
Yes.
Okay. And does anybody else here in this program participating have these motility? Oh, does anybody have bladder involvement?
Yes.
Does anybody on this program have fecal incontinence?
No.
Sometimes.
Depends on the day.
Okay. Depends on the day. Yeah. Like New England weather, let's have it today. Does anybody else who has a motility problem or multiple motility problems, well, let me ask this first. Does anybody have a motility problem that has just remained in that one area of the digestive tract?
No.
Interesting.
No.
So
yeah.
In all of, most of you on this call, it's progressed to include other parts
yes.
of evangelism.
Yes.
Yeah.
How many of you, along with your motility problem, have other diseases or symptoms that maybe or may not be related to the motility problem?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
Wow,
yes.
That's very, very interesting. How many of you had your disease and then as a result of that disease got your motility problem?
Yes.
Yes.
Ah, so there's nobody who had a motility problem and then as a result of that got some other medical problem.
Well, I did get more on top after getting GB.
Okay.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I have other disabilities, and then I got more health issues on top.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. So the Me
yeah.
Too person, if you care to speak about that, can you tell us a little bit more about that, the egg or the chicken, which came first? If the Me person doesn't, that's fine.
I don't know if you're talking to me. This is Bethany. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Bethany.
Yeah. I don't know, yeah, which came first. My motility problem started in my right colon, and they eventually took all of the colon out, and it spread up my small intestine, kind of skipped over my stomach, although I think that's starting to kick in now, and then it's really bad in my esophagus. And then, of course,
yeah.
I have a bunch of other diseases. I'm sure everyone's adrenal glands quit working. I'm sure everyone's having problems with, like, pancreatic issues, blood sugar issues, and stuff like that. I don't know.
I'm going to have to
yeah, lots of problems.
Yeah. It's not unusual. I mean, sometimes these motility problems can be a result of the secondary to a disease. So in other words, if you have, for example, MS or gastroparesis, there could, I mean, it doesn't happen in all cases, but you have a propensity towards these things. In other cases, it can be from surgery. It can be from taking too many narcotics. It can be from viruses. They're finding a lot of research done on that.
For sure.
So there are many, many different causes and theories still going around because the GI tract is just so complex and they're learning so much about it still. But it also can be what they call idiopathic, which is where mine fell into, or can be genetic in nature too. But it can also be idiopathic. And it seems like with a lot of us, once we get that motility problem, then either the disease, initial disease, but not the motility disease, is that going, or all of a sudden you're healthy and then, boom, all of these other diseases start coming in. And I don't know if it's an autoimmune problem, which they're doing research on that. What they're finding, too, is, you know, I've gotten a lot of questions from people that say, well, do you have a thyroid problem? How many of you have a thyroid problem?
Yes.
I had autoimmune, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How many of you have had headaches, migraines?
Oh, yes.
Me, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. How many of you have autonomic problems? If you don't know what that is, just say you don't know.
I have it.
My GI said that I did.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, so the autonomic system is, it controls the parts of your body that you have no control of. For example, your heart, your I was going to say eyelashes, but no. But your heart is, sure, it controls your That's the only thing that works on me is my eyelashes. That's what I was thinking about. But let me just say that, for example, you have your heart. You can't regulate your heartbeat. It controls itself. And so that autonomic system is part of that. Sweating, that type of thing. It controls your body temperature. When you have an impairment of the autonomic system, and you have a motility problem, you may feel like you're ready to pass out. You may feel that you you can't take light, you can't take sound, you can't take crowds. You feel like you're going to pass out getting from a lying down position to an upright position. And it's not that every patient has these things. It's just like everything else with us, we may have some of those. A lot of patients can't control their temperature. Like in my case, especially after I'm eating or while I'm eating, my body's working so hard to digest whatever little I'm consuming that suddenly you just feel like you're going to pass out. I'm hot, I'm cold, I'm hot, I'm cold. It's like being in a perpetual menopause, but it isn't. It's that the autonomic system is having trouble regulating your temperature, the body. And so I could be doing something for 1 minute, and the next thing you know, I have to put a sweater on, and then just a second later, I'm sweating. But I'm not really sweating. My body doesn't sweat. So I don't know if any of you are experiencing that, but if you are, you're not alone, because a lot of us do have that. So that's another thing, and these are the common threads that people think, oh, you know, I just have this. This is another layer that I'm dealing with, another symptom. But when you survey a lot of the motility patients, some are very surprised to say, oh, wow, I have that too. Raynaud's is another one, Raynaud's phenomenon. I don't know if any of you have that. The inability to be able to tolerate the cold. And if your hands or your feet begin to turn different colors, that can happen. So these are some common threads that not everybody has, but certainly it's enough for our group to speculate, if we have just a handful of these patients and we're finding more and more, is there some connection?
I don't think they do enough testing to find out if it is autonomic.
Yeah.
I think they say, okay, it's gastroparesis, ferro-pseudo, mm-hmm. It's not your autonomic.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's the vagus, it's autonomic.
Yeah. I don't know if any of you, if you are able to eat, and you do eat, if you find that your body is working so hard and that a lot of those autonomic systems go into feel heightened.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes, sometimes, you know, I didn't realize that they're hot and cold, and there are times when I get real hot and then sometimes I get real cold. I didn't realize that can be autonomic. I wasn't aware.
Yeah, I'm not diagnosing you because certainly I'm not a doctor. I'm just saying, I mean, it could be other things. It could be thyroid problem. It could be just your body working so hard to digest whatever you're consuming. But it may be, and I don't think that it's tested as often as perhaps it should. And that brings me to another topic or another disease which I've spoken about in some of these programs, which is mitochondrial disease. Everybody has mitochondria in them. That's the cells in the body that give you that energy. But when you have a problem with mitochondrial disease and you're seeing more connection with motility disorders, including pseudo-obstruction, that it might be a problem with the whole mitochondrial system in your mitochondrial disease, which you may think that you have an idiopathic form of a disease when you find out, oh, this was the whole cause to begin with, but they didn't know about it. So that's another thing to think about. Not all patients get autonomic testing, and even with the autonomic testing, sometimes the testing comes back either normal or it comes back maybe speculative of something but not quite normal, and then it's passed off. So it's finding the right doctors and finding doctors who are knowledgeable and open to even things that you may ask about what you're going through and inquiring about the potential of connections. I know a lot of patients nowadays are researching before they even go to the doctor. And that's a good thing. It's also a bad thing because I get a lot of hysterical people saying, oh, my God, I have what you have. And then when I hear what they're saying, I'm going, oh, my, okay, this is research gone wrong. So it's great to educate yourself and to present questions to your doctor or whoever you're seeing, the practitioner, so that they understand where you're coming from, but also that you are providing information of concerns that are in your mind, and you need that reassurance.
Agree.
Definitely. Another part of dealing with the fear, which I alluded to, is taking tests. For many of us, you know, taking a test really is a huge decision because we want to know, but we know sometimes the test is taxing on the body. That's
yep.
one part of it. The second part is, well, if I take the test and it comes back normal, even though I'm having these symptoms, now we're back to square one. Where does that lead me? So you almost pray that it comes back mm-hmm. with a positive result, but at the same time, you're fearful, oh, my God, if it does come back positive, now what? So all of these other fears go into your head. And I wonder, and I'm sure all of you may have gone through this in your experience through your journey with motility problems.
The yo-yo of the outcome.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I know that the prospect of taking doing a barium study and swallowing that barium is like a nightmare. And now the doctor just looks and says, I know you should be having this, but I know you and I know you won't. So I'm okay with that if you're okay with that. And the same for colonoscopy. I mean, when I turned 50, they said, you know, you really should have one, but I'm not even going to ask you because I know your answer. I pick and choose my battles because in some cases, I already know what I have, and we know it's progressing and getting worse. So what is that going to accomplish? Because there are no treatments that are available for me at this time in my particular case. That doesn't mean I advocate that for everybody, but I'm sure there's that thought process in many patients. Some patients will do anything. Yep, I'll take the barium in spite of it, let alone cleansing out your system before you take a lot of these tests. If you have pseudo-obstruction, that's not going anywhere.
I couldn't imagine keeping the claims down.
Yeah. Some people can take the preparation for colonoscopy, and they can take any type of thing that would move a fleet, and then they get rejected because it's not clear. They can't go through with it. So it's very, very hard, and a lot of patients, when they have to take all of these solutions, also vomit it right back up, or they just can't get the whole thing down. Some of the preps are, what are they giving you? All of this stuff. You have to drink it, and you're full, and you have to drink it, and you're full. I don't know how, you know, a lot of people like you do it.
Well, Mary Angela, one of the things that I did, this is Anam for my colonoscopy.
I'm sorry, Anam. Could you speak up, please?
One of the things that I did for my colonoscopy.
Anam, we still can't hear you. You're very, very faint, and I know you have a very strong voice.
Can you hear me now?
Better.
Can you hear me?
You got to shout it out.
Yeah. One of the things that I did with my colonoscopy is I asked the doctor, I said, can I have like a bottle of magnesium? They wanted me to drink three bottles. I ended up throwing up a whole bottle, and, you know, they found out the colonoscopy was normal, but they did, but like I could never do a barium stuff because it would just sit in me, you know, it wouldn't go through.
Yeah. So, barium is constipating to begin with. And when
it
you have any
demon.
Type of it really does. It is just like that. That's what I always said, not putting cement in my mouth. You know, put it on the steps, but that's not going in. And so if it sits there, I mean, it's like swallowing a rock. It just is like a rock. And then normal people, they just say, well, you know, within a few days, you'll be fine. You'll be passing it. You should be fine. But with us, we probably still have barium in us from years ago that we took because we really get our money's worth on things. We're like a bank. We just save and save and save all this stuff unless we give a refund and we vomit it up. That's it in a nutshell. Not a pretty sight, but that's what happens.
Yes.
Yep, exactly. The other concern is because we're allergic to so many things and taking some of the tests, dyes that they may use and things like that become a concern because you don't know. I don't know if any of you on this call have problems with sensitivities or allergies to different medications.
I used to be allergic to nothing, and now I'm allergic to everything. It's embarrassing how long my list is, and they think I'm crazy.
But you shouldn't be embarrassed. That's so, so common, and I know it's not easy to just say don't be embarrassed, but that's how everybody is built. But what you usually get is I don't believe you. However, that's another common thread with many of us. Things that we could, medications that we could take as children, we now can't take them because the immune system goes into this pattern of unacceptable, you know, when it's just not accepting this. And the immune system is the way of protecting that body. And so many of us have that. And our list keep getting longer and longer and longer. Some of them may be a rash. Some of it may be hives. Some of it may be wheezing. But I was told that even if you get a little bit of a reaction from it, like a rash, and then you say, well, I'll stop taking this and it'll be fine, indicate that you are getting a reaction, because even if I know with latex, I would use one of the latex gloves years ago just to help me when I was giving myself enemas, which the water never came out. I would give myself 3 enemas and the water still would not come out. So what I would always put myself with gloves on, even to wean any of the stool out, which I would have to do and still do. So I would get a little rash on the buttock and I'd say, what the heck is going on now? And I did that for years, but I noticed that it was starting to get very irritated. And then when I had gone actually for some oral surgery, the doctor said, are you allergic to latex? And I said, no, but I am getting a little rash. He says, you need to address that right away, because that can evolve into a major...
it can turn into anaphylaxis.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So you don't dismiss a little rash. But on the other hand, we get a lot of us get rashes and we don't know what the heck they're from, so it's hard to discern. But if you're making a connection, if you're able to make a connection, do indicate. And what my allergist had told me, because the list was so long, do you know when you got this reaction? What was the year? What was the date? And what was that reaction? And make sure you keep a log of that, because that helps instead of just showing the whole list and going, oh, this is what I had. And then somebody corners and said, well, what was your reaction? And you're trying to remember. But it's not uncommon for many of us to have these different reactions to things that we were able to. Very common.
I sure have an anaphylaxis to stuff. I have to carry an EpiPen and everything.
Oh, my God. That's so frightening. What
I know. That, it is
that's
scary.
A ditto.
Bethany, if you don't mind me saying, asking, tell me a little bit more about that. Were you in the hospital when it happened, or were you at home?
Yeah, here's what's been happening lately. I'm on all these different, which I don't necessarily agree with this, but I'm on all these different antibiotics that I'm supposed to take consistently.
Yeah.
Like I'll take 2 weeks of this antibiotic and then immediately switch to this other one and have like 2 weeks off every month. But anyways, for these small bacterial overgrowth infections. But anyways, the last few times I was in the hospital, I was given IV forms of these because I'm in with an obstruction. I can't take anything orally. And things that I had taken before and done just fine, like Flagyl. I mean, who's allergic to Flagyl? Like no one. All of a sudden, I had anaphylaxis.
Me.
And they bring in the stat team, and they, you know, a million people are in your room, and they're giving you, like, nebulizer treatments with epinephrine. I'm just like, ah. But then, and then they're like, oh, well, it can't possibly be the Flagyl. I bet it's the fentanyl patch in your arm. So they take the fentanyl patch off, and then they come in the next day and give me another dose of IV Flagyl. I'm like, dude, I know it's a Flagyl. And then I have another anaphylaxis reaction. And so I talk them into putting the patch back on. And then, so anyways, it's just things like that. I've had, I forget what the other one was, but I've had lots of issues like that.
Yeah, that's very frightening. So another fear that many of us carry is if you have to put a new medication in, how is you going to, we don't trust our body. So how is your body going to react? and then you have to wait.
Even medications you've been taking, all of a sudden, just one time, it can be that time that you're going to have anaphylaxis to it.
Yep. It's kind of like, because of the unpredictable nature of it, some people, when they eat, they can eat that food once, and then all of a sudden they try eating that exact same food, and then all of a sudden, boom, they're getting the symptoms. Or then they start to omit that particular thing from their diet as a result of that. So that fear with foods, fear with going out, fear with medications, fear of taking tests, all of these things are just the little chatters that so many of us have to go through. And, you know, it's not easy, but somehow we all get through it. And in spite of all these fears, it certainly shows, it exemplifies greatly the courage that each and every one of you have. And you dig down somewhere in your heart to have that strength and determination to get through it. And by you sharing what you've gone through with us here today and with many others, and even if you've just been listening and not have shared your voice, you all are the heroes. That's how I always say. I don't like to close these programs without saying that you really are my inspiration. You are all heroes as you go through your life, and you really are living in my heart and in my mind and in my prayers every single day. And I am just so grateful to provide this opportunity and for all of you to just be here, and hopefully you gain something out of this program. On that note, Laura, thank you. Thank all of you for attending our group today. I hope you will be with us next month. We haven't posted the date yet, but it will be next month. And I hope that all of you, I hope that all of you have a day that at least filled with some bright spots.
Mary Angela, can I throw something in real quick?
Yes.
Okay, iThrive does have a weekly webinar with doctors and nutritional experts and everything on Wednesdays. And all anyone has to do is sign up.
Yes, they're a great company. I have nothing but high praise. I knew them when they were first becoming incorporated, and they reached out to us during one of our symposiums, and that's how I got to know them. And each and every person that I have met in that company have been just phenomenal. You can tell they're there for the right reason. And
they reached out to me.
Yeah.
Is it for TPN? Yep. Is that a support group for
all
for
of the above?
Okay.
Yeah.
They do the peritoneal and internal feedings, but then specialize in motility disorders.
Yeah, they're great.
Okay.
Excellent. I have nothing but high praise for them, so a great resource. Them and the Oley Foundation. And we don't gain anything by mentioning this, so I don't want you to think that we're getting some gain. If the only gain we get is that we're able to, with confidence, provide resources for patients, then hopefully that will help. And
spread our wings.
Yes. And now, unfortunately, we're going to be cutting off in the middle of sentence. So I just want to thank you all again and know that I'm thinking of you. And if you have any questions, you want to reach our organization, you can either do it on our website, www.agmd-gimotility.org, or you have the email, the word digestive.motility@gmail.com. And you have the phone number, 781-275-1300. And if you could just watch me saying all that, I've been moving my hands because I can't talk without moving my hands. So just incision and Italian out of control, because that's what I am. Even as I sit here in my office, my hands are moving as much as my mouth. So take care, everybody, and I look forward to hopefully having you at our next meeting.
Bye-bye.
Mary Ellen.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.